Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let's get to my conversation with Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry is a filmmaker and an industry. He's made 24 feature films, many of which he starred in, including his comic Madea franchise, about a cantankerous and hilarious older woman whose family is always up to something. According to Newsweek, Perry's 14 Madea movies have grossed more than $670 million. He's written best-selling books. He has a 330-acre studio production complex in Atlanta, Georgia. But now he has a new drama out, one he wrote 27 years ago and waited for the right time to make. It's a film that is a serious look at love, race, and violence set in the Deep South. And it has an amazing soundtrack. The name of the film is A Jazz Man's Blues. Let's listen to one of the tracks. This is Paper Airplanes.
You are the song that I long to hear once more. You are the light that I keep looking for. Roses are blue. If it isn't me and you, I've gotta see this thing through. And I'll spend
for A Jazz Man's Blues, Perry enlisted the help of Terrence Blanchard with the score, as well as choreographer Debbie Allen for some of the dance sequences. A Jazz Man's Blues takes place in the 1930s and 40s. It tells the story of Bayou, a sweet, creative teenager who falls in love with a girl who is visiting her grandfather in a southern country town for the summer. Her name is Leanne, and she loves Bayou back something fierce. Leanne's mother forces her to leave town, hoping for something else for her daughter. The young lovers are crushed that their romance is over. Fast forward to their adulthood, and Bayou has become a huge jazz singer, as you just heard. And Leanne is now passing as white and married into a family of racists. When she tries to rekindle her true love with Bayou, it is both dangerous and leads to tragedy. The film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival and was recently released on Netflix. And right now, it's hovering at the top of its most watched films list. The Guardian calls it Tyler Perry's magnum opus. And Variety says, quote, it proves he should get serious more often. I spoke with Tyler Perry last week at the 92nd Street Y. He spoke candidly about his childhood and how he turned his self-protective mechanisms of disassociation into a tool for creativity. We also discussed how he would sneak into theaters when he couldn't afford tickets. It involved him being crafty about smoking breaks. And how he approached directing actors who were more used to a Broadway stage than a Hollywood film. I want to let you know, this was in front of a live studio audience, and it sounds like it, so you'll hear some clapping, you'll hear some laughing, you'll hear some ambient noise, but it was all part of the experience. I began by asking Tyler Perry if there was a specific moment in A Jazz Man's Blues that he felt particularly proud of. Let's listen.
I can honestly say that this is the first time I've ever enjoyed directing. So I enjoyed every frame of every moment. There was nothing on this film that was a challenge because I'd held it so long that I enjoyed every moment. I wanted every frame to look like a photograph. In all of the madness and sadness and chaos, I wanted it all to be beautiful. So I can't pinpoint something that was difficult. I loved it all.
For people who don't know the backstory, this was written 27 years ago.
27 now, yeah.
That's pre-Google. That's pre-iPhone.
Yeah, pre-Madea.
Pre-Madea.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what did your writing situation look like? Was it your computer? Did you have to go to a library? What was going on?
No, I had a computer. It had been in and out of the pawn shop so much. I had the pawn tickets taped to it. So, but I couldn't afford to go to theater. So I heard there was an August Wilson play in town called Two Trains Running Two Trains Running at the Alliance Theater. And I snuck in, you know, back then when people would smoke, all the patrons would go out at intermission, and I would wait until they went back in, and then I pretended I had money and what ticket, and I'd go in and sit down. And I got a chance to meet him afterwards, and I had just done this play called I Know I've Been Changed, and it wasn't working, and it was failing, and I needed some sort of something to keep me going. And he was so encouraging and so kind. I described the play to him, and he said to me, you know what, go and write what's in your heart. Write what you feel. And I went home to that computer, and Jazzman started to flow out of me back then. So.
Did the story, was the story in your heart, or were the characters in your heart? Which came first?
Well, the way that I write, I don't necessarily think about what I'm going to write. I'll sit down, and sometimes I get a scene. A character will show up. I'll be driving or walking down the street, or somebody will say something in my head, hi, I'm by you. I'm like, okay, I'll remember that. And then when I sit down to write, that character will start to tell the story to me. They'll dictate what it is, and I feel like I'm just the vessel that's just telling me what they want to hear. So that's how it all starts with me. I don't have a outline. I don't have a plan. I just start to listen to them. And sometimes I'll get 3 and 4 scenes and put them away and not know what they're for. And then months later, something else will come. And then I was like, oh, that's what that is. And it'll all come together.
When you were, you know, sometimes when someone's trying to write their first big, whatever, make your first big album you make, or your first play, or your first half-hour comedy, you know, your stand-up, you have things that you've had in your mind for a long time. That's going to be in my first thing.
Yeah.
What had you been noodling on that you knew was going to be in this particular script?
There was nothing that I was noodling on, or I'm telling you, that moment from August Wilson, it struck something in me, and it was permission to tell all kinds of stories. And I do know that subconsciously there was a lot of my own life that creeped into Jazzman, especially with Bayou. Initially, I wanted to play the role of Bayou, and then I looked at it now, 27 years later, there's no way I was gonna be able to pull off a 17-year-old. Oh, I had a whole cast. It was me and Will Smith as my brother, and Halle Berry as Leanne, and Diana Ross as our mother. I wanted Sir Ben Kingsley. Yeah, I had a plan. But, you know, time and life had another plan. So I had the cast in mind, but that was about it. Yeah.
Since you brought up the cast, I think it's interesting that there were so many fantastic actors who aren't capital F famous in this cast. What does that afford you creatively?
Well, first of all, for the audience to see it and not recognize the face, it gives you an opportunity to not have to get over the fame of it all, the capital F, as you say. You can just fall into the story. I reached out to a bunch of up-and-coming actors, you know, to say, listen, I really want you to think about doing this. And they read it. They really liked it. And then they thought, oh, you know, there was always some sort of an excuse. And I knew what it was, right? It's like they thought Madea was going to pop out from behind an oak tree or something. I'm like, no, I clearly get it. I understand that this is different. Trust me, I know what I've done in the past, but I know what this is. So I was trying to find a crop of talent that harkened back to that kind of commitment to the craft, like Denzel Washington, Howard Rollins, and Lawrence Fishburne in The Soldier Story, right? So that started on stage. So I said, where do I find these people? And of course, it was here in New York on Broadway, on stage. That's where you found it. I found them. And I also found that they're in a clique. They all know each other. That because when Austin Scott, who was in Hamilton, was the first person that I hired, and I said, well, what do you think for this role and this role? And he gave me amazing suggestions, and they all had that same level of, we understand what we're doing, we understand the period, we understand the time, and they approached it the way they would a Broadway show. And I think that's part of the reason that the performances are so phenomenal.
We were talking backstage about how much we love Broadway actors because they show up on time. Doing a live radio show, they're always on time.
Yeah.
They're always ready.
Yep.
They're always engaged. Mm-hmm. So though you have, they are Broadway, those are all the great things. What were some of the things you had to work with your stage actors? Some of whom, this was one of their first experiences with film.
Yeah. So Leia, I shouldn't say this, but I will. Don't tell nobody. Just she being her first time, we were under the gun the first week in Savannah because all of the interiors were shot at the studio, but all of the exteriors were shot in Savannah. And I was always trying to get the light because the light had to be right. And the DP, Brett Pollock, who's brilliant, he would say to me, okay, we got 13 minutes to get this shot. It's like, where's Saleha? Go get her. She didn't understand the importance of the light and having to be there in that moment. So I was about to get really frustrated, and I sat her down and I said, let me explain to you, let me show you what it is. And she was like, I got it. So the education of it was something that I had to share with them so they knew what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, I said it to her one time and she got it, she understood, and she showed up like, you see the performance. I mean, she just showed up.
And she's going to be starring, I believe, in Almost Famous.
Yes, in Almost
Famous.
On Broadway.
Right. So she's
an incredible singer.
Her voice is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
She said in this interview.
She's not Almost Famous anymore. Something's coming.
And to give you a sense of where she was, in an interview she said, in early 2021, I was in New York and making most of my living either singing at online corporate events or coaching singers online.
Yeah.
So that's just a year ago.
A year ago,
about.
Yeah.
What is something that you learned or were reminded of working with young, fresh, new faces and new actors?
I think having some of those people who said they weren't interested forced me to remember what I had done since the beginning of my career. I had worked with and helped some really incredible people find their footing. You know, there was a time when it was very difficult for black actors to get work in Hollywood, and they came to work with me. I gave Idris Elba his first film, Daddy's Little Girls. And Viola Davis was in Madea Goes to Jail. I mean, think about that, Viola Davis. And I'll never forget, she did this one scene, and I after it was over, I walked up to her, I said, who are you? Who are you and what are you doing here? I knew that there was something incredible there. You know, but if you look at Sofia Vergara and Kerry Washington, and I mean, the list goes on and on of the people that I've worked with very early on, from Taraji on. So to have an opportunity to have these new faces, get that opportunity and see them thrive in it, that's a wonderful feeling. That's a wonderful feeling. So I want to always be able to do that.
We won't tell anybody, but what are some of the secrets to good casting?
You know, for me, honestly, I always look for... the person may not always be the most talented in the audition, because some people just are not there in the audition, but I look for that thing that shows up or something they show me in just 1 second that I didn't see in the character. Mm-hmm. Like, I had an idea for a character on one of my TV shows that this is what the person looks like. I know it. I saw it in my mind. There was another woman who was the total opposite of what I thought, but she was so phenomenal. I realized, oh, no. You are the character. So anytime an actor walks in and shows me something that I didn't see, I'm all for it.
How long did it take you to write this script?
You know, when people ask me how long, I'm often judged because...
We're judgment-free zone.
because I tell you, you have to understand how I write. Because I write very, very quickly. Like, if it were 2 weeks, I'd be surprised to write this. Because, and I tell you why, because out of my childhood, there was a lot of pain and a lot of trauma, and I didn't realize this until much later on. In those dark days, I could go into my imagination and be in a whole different world. And I would sit in my room for hours in that world, and I can tell you every detail in that world, from what the bees sound like flying by, to what's plugged in the outlet, to what curtains were on the wall. Wherever I was, I could describe it to you perfectly. And I didn't know that is the place where I would disassociate to in the trauma to get through it, is now the place that I go to when I write. I had no idea. And that's why when I sit down to write it, it comes. It just completely comes. It completely flows. So it's a 12, 14-hour day of just sitting at the computer and just hearing these people in my head and getting it all out.
It sounds almost spiritual.
For me, absolutely, I think it is, for sure. That something so traumatic could be used for something that is so creative and to help me be free and that has opened all of these doors for me. Yeah, that's all things working together for your good. That's exactly what I believe it is.
I think a lot of folks know that when you talk to older folks, they don't always like to talk about passing.
Yeah.
It's a difficult subject. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Well, it was a difficult choice that had to be made. And the generation before us and beyond, there was this sense of silence. You never spoke about anything. And I think that was just destroying us as a society, how we held on to everything. But passing was a very difficult choice to make. You had an opportunity to live better in America than you ever could have if you were deemed a Negro. So to make the choice to leave family and everything you know to pass just so that you can have what most would think is a better life, that's a hard choice. It's a hard choice, yeah.
What did you want to investigate about passing?
I don't know if I wanted to investigate anything about it, as, again, because I'm surrendering to what the characters are saying. So when it's on paper and I read it, or if I watch it and I look back at it, I'm often thinking about their motivation, like what brought you here, what got you to this place. And when I think about someone like Carol Channing, who passed, and you know, Hello Dolly, what would her life had been like had she not? And she said that, and I think it was in her autobiography, she talked about the choices that were made and how difficult they were. But for me, in watching it, I never judged the characters. I just let them tell me what they want to say and be who they are in my vision.
That's interesting. Do you understand your characters?
Not all of them. Okay. Not all of them. I don't understand. Sometimes they'll say things and why are you doing this? Or why are you saying that?
Yeah.
And again, if I judge them from my lens, I would want to mold them into something else rather than letting them be the way they show up. And what I found in a lot of my work in letting people show up the way they show up is those people who see themselves in that, it's life-changing for them. So I learned very early on to just let it be what it is and not try to mold it into something else, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I had questions about, you know, I've interviewed a lot of older folks, and one of
when you say older, I'm 53.
I'm 56, so I'm like our elders.
Okay, got
our
it. Elders. Okay. Because to young people, 50 is old, but to older people, 50 is young. So we're right there in the middle. Yeah.
I just mean like our parents and our grandparents. Yeah. And I remember one gentleman saying to me, well, you can pass over, but you can't come back.
Yeah.
Right? That's a very strong feeling.
Yeah.
And it's something I thought when I was watching the film, is Leanne ignorant to this? Or is she just so overcome by love? Or why does she believe she might be able to come back?
I think that it's more than anything being a 17-year-old in the time. And having a mother who, you know, the parents in those days, you did exactly what they told you to do. And I think she found herself in a situation that wasn't something that she wanted to be in for sure, but it's also the love that they had for each other was crossing time and space. Even to the end of the movie, you see her sitting there with this son. Mm. Love is still crossing time and space. She has not been able to let it go. And there's a moment in the script, in the film, where she says, if something had happened to him, I would live the rest of my life here in misery. And that's exactly what she did. She stayed in the house. She lived there in the misery. And God only knows this son, thinking he's a white boy and growing up with the Confederate flag at the front of the house, what his life must have been like. And to get the realization of, I am not who I thought I was. And that is most of us in the world. We think that we have an identity and we identify with something, but if you ever just start to look back a generation or two, you might be surprised at who's peeking out in there. Yeah, yeah.
And just the whole conversations that can be had after watching this movie about race as a social construct.
Yes,
right?
Yes, and colorism. My father was a person who was extremely abusive. I've talked about that quite often, but what I didn't mention very much is that I was a brown child, so I wasn't the child that was favored. My sister was very light-skinned with light eyes, and he just adored her. And me and my other sister, we were the brown children, so there was this horrible... within our own culture, there is this hierarchy because of the color of the skin, which I think has been passed down since we got to America. And when I was writing by you and I read that and it started to creep in, I think maybe that's some of my own stuff showing up, when he and his father.
That was the first part of my conversation with Tyler Perry about A Jazz Man's Blues, recorded last week at the 92nd Street Y. We'll have more coming up after a short break. Stay with us. The This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Let's get back to my conversation I had with Tyler Perry at the 92nd Street Y last week. He wrote, produced, and directed the film A Jazz Man's Blues, which is now available on Netflix. The film is set in the Jim Crow South, and it deals with racism and violence. A woman passing for white hopes to rekindle a childhood love affair with a black man, a dangerous and ultimately deadly act. But at its heart, it's really a love story about the two. I asked him why that was a good vehicle to talk about social justice issues.
I don't know anybody who has love without having obstacles, without having issues, without being present in the world. And looking at what's happening right now, there are people who are in love, while at the same time having to deal with the politics of what is going on in America, right? Take the banning of books, the homogenization of slavery and Jim Crow, and certain political figures not wanting people to learn about our history, all of that. But there are still people in love inside of that, right? So I feel like the love story was the nucleus for it all, and there were all of these other things that were trying to tear it apart, but the love was evident throughout.
Gender is interesting in the film. You have some really strong women, women running their own businesses, right? As truth tellers.
Yeah.
What does it take to write, well, first of all, was that intentional? Or again, was this the spirit coming to you and saying, here are these women and they are going to populate this universe?
They're going to tell their stories. They're going to tell their stories the way they do. But of course, subconsciously, my upbringing informed all of that, for sure. My mother would play cards in the projects with a bunch of women, black women, on every Friday night. And they didn't have more than a 12th grade education, but they were all smart. And one woman would be talking about her man and her pain and how difficult it was at the time, and another woman would come in and make a joke and they'd all start laughing. But so you feel the ebb and flow and the rise and fall of the pain and the laughter in the room. And I'm a 5-year-old kid in the corner with my Matchbox cars hearing all of it. Mm-hmm. I was in a master class for my life. And I don't know how I could have grown up to be a black man in America at the apron of my mother, watching her and my sisters and my aunts and those women endure the things that they have and not have some sort of understanding and compassion for that kind of struggle and pain, right? So anytime I'm writing a female character, a woman of strength or a woman that is broken or a woman who's trying to find a way, I'm thinking about those women. And subconsciously, for the first 10 movies I did, I was crying out to my mother. I didn't even realize until I watched it play some of them play back, I was going, wow, that is so me talking to my mother.
Can you think of, in your career, a decision you made that you know really made all the difference? Something you said yes to, maybe something you said no to.
Yes, I remember having a opportunity to do a show for CBS and with Chuck Lorre. He had done Roseanne and he had this Tyler Perry show and 2 and a Half Men. And my agents, everybody talked me into doing it, and I was completely against it. Everything in me was like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And I got into the room and they were giving all these notes and changes to the ideas that I wanted to do. I was like, well, that's not how black people talk. You know, we speak this way, we want to do this. And my agent is going, are you crazy? This is Chuck Lorre, this is CBS, this is huge. Mm. So I signed that deal and I prayed every day that it would fall apart. So I finally got a call from him saying, and my agent, this is some of the best acting I've ever done. They're like, Tyler, we're so sorry, but Chuck is going to go with 2 and a Half Men, and we're sorry that he's not going to do your show, and I know this is devastating for you. I was like, yes, it's very devastating. Thank God that did not happen. So that's one of those decisions. But it was that forced me to go to Atlanta and start my own studio and do my own shows and start... telling it the way that I knew my audience wanted to see it. Yeah.
It sounded like you knew in your gut
Yeah.
not to do it. but you weren't necessarily trusting your gut initially. At what point did you feel confident enough to trust your gut?
I like to say that I always was a person that went with my gut, but sometimes you let outside voices in. Mm-hmm. Here I was doing these shows, traveling, doing about 300 performances a year, selling out all over the country from Indiana, and I was exhausted, and I wanted to find a way to reach more people. How do I do that? Movies and television. Mm-hmm. So in my trying to get an understanding of how this works, I went to Hollywood and asked people, you know, how does this work? Well, Tyler, you do a pilot. If the pilot gets picked up one episode, then it all works. Well, how can they tell if it's going to work for one episode? So I learned in progress to trust myself and what I felt inside, because every time I've gone with that voice for me, which I believe to be the voice of God, that gut instinct, when I'm listening, when that's in tune and I do what I'm being led to do, it always works out right. Every time I don't, mm-hmm. I find myself in some mess. So I've learned the hard way to stop, get quiet, get centered, and listen to that voice.
This film looks so beautiful. Mm. It really looks beautiful. Your DP is, let's give him a shout.
Brett Pollack.
You know, it's been an issue for years in Hollywood and in fashion about how to light black people, make people of color look good.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how you and your DP made everybody look good.
Well, that was the decision very early on when I started looking at DPs. I said, listen, I need somebody who understands this period, but also understands black skin, how it absorbs light. There's nothing worse than seeing a movie, especially for a black actor, to see a movie and the white person in the scene with the black person is lit beautifully, because the light is on them and the light was designed for them, but then the black person doesn't even register. They look gray or there's just something so wrong with the skin tone because there was all the focus was on the white person because they absorbed the light, right? Or need less light. So that was, in interviewing DPs, that was a major thing. Like, my first question is, how do you light black skin? I want to know. And he has an appreciation for it. It's something that he loves to see the light hit and sparkle and dance off of. He understands what it means. So that was that he was a shoe in there. And he hadn't done much. Hmm. But two things I needed to know was, how do you light black skin and can you move at my pace? I shoot very quickly because I'm not indecisive. I know what I want and there's very little waste. If we added up all the waste in movies in Hollywood, we can support major countries. And I'm not kidding you. Because people who don't know what decisions to make when they are before they get to set. So when I walk on the set, being someone who writes the check, I know what I'm spending for you to sit around here. Why are you sitting over there in the corner? We're ready to shoot. You can't come in there thinking, I think I want to move the light here. No, there. No, let's put it here. Oh, wait, it'll be great over here. Figure out all that before we get on. Yeah, so no. Not doing that.
You invest in pre-production.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about the costumes, too.
Yes, Karen Wagner. Karen Wagner did the costumes.
What kind of, did you work with her on research? Did she come to you with her lookbook?
She brought the lookbook to me, and Karen is so incredibly brilliant. We're working on a new movie right now. But for me, I'm like, I hired you to do the job. Do the job. We'll talk about the colors. We'll get with the DP. We'll know what it should feel like. But go do the job. And Karen does the job, but she also wants to tell me about the stitch inside the slip in the seam that nobody's going to see. I'm like, Karen, I don't need to know that that's an authentic stitch from 1940. You know that, and all the historians will know that. That's great. But right now, I got all these people waiting over here to shoot this scene. So, but her eye and her level of detail is just, she's unmatched. She's unmatched. And I just can't wait for people to really see it and take it all in.
And I remember interviewing who was it? Oh gosh, I'm forgetting. He was nominated for Academy Award last year. And he was the costume designer. And he was talking about how important it is to find the right button, because the button is 10 feet tall.
Well, that's
that's the whole thing.
That's her, and that's why I hired her.
Yeah.
Because I would have had buttons from Sears from 1982. So
in your button drawer?
Yeah, from my button drawer. So I get it. So I hired the best people to put them in the best situations and seats to make sure that they were making the film all that I had imagined it would be.
Should we get to some audience questions?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. How did revisiting this piece influence the Tyler Perry of today? That's from Cameron.
Oh, wow. How did it, how visiting influence?
Revisiting this work.
Revisiting. From, I tell you what I had to do in my entire life. I knew that as a black person in Hollywood, and I know we're talking about race, but I really want you to hear this from a very sincere place, because I've been very fortunate enough to sit on both sides of all arguments now and see it, because I'm a business owner, I'm a director, I'm an actor, so. But to sit in the seat and watch, read that question to me again.
How did revisiting this piece influence the Tyler Perry of today?
Right, yes, I was talking about intentionality. So I knew that if I did something like a period piece and took a risk in 10, 15 years ago, if it wasn't a huge success, then I would not have had an opportunity to do something else. So I had to be specific in what I was doing. I had to focus, hyper-focus, uber-focus on my audience, super-serve my niche. Madea, Why Did I Get Married? Movies that were broad and were loved, and what happened was I was able to build my business, my studio, my career, my brand, and get to a place where I was solid in the business. So that now, I can do Jazz Man. I have a World War II piece that I'm working on next that I want to do. I have a zombie movie that I'm working on that I want to do. So now I feel a lot more free to establish and explore some of those other sides of the creative that I hold. So that's how it's informed me.
Why was it important to present the injustice and persecution of both Jewish and black folks at the time?
My mother worked at a Jewish community center when I was a kid, and I'll never forget her coming home in tears. And I asked her what was wrong, and she was saying that was a bomb threat. She just couldn't believe that there was so much hate for Jewish people in Louisiana that somebody would actually want to bomb these children that she took care of. And the parallels of her and us growing up, and her in the Jim Crow South, being right across the border in Louisiana after the Emmett Till murder when she was very young, all of that was very present in her mind. So there's always been this companionship. If you look at what happened with the civil rights workers and all of the people that, even in the NAACP, the establishment of it there, all of the people that were on board to help black people overcome and get better, there's always been this Jewish, black, colored Negro combination that was very powerful. And I think it comes from the pain that we all experienced and had to overcome. And I wanted to explore it in this. And I got to tell you, Ryan Eggle, I think he delivered a phenomenal moment when he starts talking about the survivor of the Holocaust.
Did you consider not including the lynching scene, or did you feel it gave the story the raw moment to grasp the severity of how it was at the time?
I was asked to take it out, the actual end, I was asked to take it out, but I didn't want to do it because I don't want to make it palatable for people today, because people actually endured this, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to water it down, because it actually happened, and it was awful, and it was tragic, and it was horrible. And I have a 7-year-old son who is so far removed from the world that I grew up in. Like when he comes home and he's talking about the kids at school, he's 7 years old, and I have never heard him describe a white kid or a black kid, or when he describes them, he talks about their hair color or their clothes, right? So he doesn't understand the world that I grew up in. But I never want him to get so far down the lane in that world that he doesn't recognize what he's come from and what we've endured so that he can be here. So that for me is very important. So I wouldn't change it because of that.
Do you ever get emotional while directing a film? This is Sherry Cullen. She's from Harlem.
Yes, Sherry, I get emotional. Every time I'm doing a Madea scene, I get so emotional. No, I'm joking. Every day on this was emotional for me, because 27 years I carried it and held it, and through everything, through all the critics, through all of the what everybody's saying, I'm like, I know I got this baby here that I'm holding on to, and one day I'll get a chance to do it. So every day on set was emotional, and after it was over, I found myself grieving, and I didn't know what it was up until a couple of weeks ago. I was like, what is this feeling of sadness? And I realized it's only thing I can equate it to, even though I haven't experienced this yet, is a kid going off to college and the house being empty. Yeah. I felt like I gave my baby to the world, and it's a very exciting time, but it's also that empty feeling is there as well.
His baby is now out in the world. It's called A Jazzman's Blues, and you can watch it on Netflix, where it's been one of the most streamed movies of the past week. That was my conversation with Tyler Perry, recorded last week at the 92nd Street Y. Big thanks to our friends at the 92nd Street Y for the audio.